Welcome to the Giving Voice to Depression podcast. This episode is presented by Mental Health America of Wisconsin. We're your co-hosts, Terry
and Bridget.
Each week, through intimate, candid conversations with guests, we explore the different perspectives on and experiences of depression. We keep it real because the illness is real. We keep it hopeful because there truly is hope in spite of what depression tells you.
We're not experts or therapists. We're sisters and best friends who live with depression and have interviewed hundreds of others who do as well. By sharing personal experiences, we can all learn from each other that while depression convinces us that we're utterly alone, that our best days are in the past, and that we won't experience joy or hope again, those thoughts are symptoms, not truths. Hearing others shamelessly discuss their mental health journeys provides information, connection, and hope, taking away some of depression's power.
Hello, Bridget.
Hi, Terry. Our primary focus in this podcast is to share the stories of fellow humans who live with depression and bipolar disorder, and their often co-occurring anxiety and suicidal thoughts.
But every now and then, we need to step back and look at the system in which those mental health challenges are diagnosed and treated, including when they're most effectively addressed, where care needs to be provided, and why some of the current societal beliefs and institutional care structures can actually cause harm.
Our guest for this episode is Victor Armstrong, the director of the Division of Mental Health, Developmental Disabilities, and Substance Abuse for North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services. Here now is Victor, who also joined us last week, giving his voice to depression.
We begin by asking Victor what he thinks is least understood about depression.
I think the prevalence of depression in our society is grossly misunderstood. And I think the vulnerability of all of us to depression is also grossly misunderstood.
And those misunderstandings are not benign. They have real consequences because, as Victor puts it, people fear what they don't understand.
And so I think all of those things have culminated into us really trying to paint people with mental health challenges as being other people. It's not something that impacts me. I think that's the reason that when we look statistically, only about half the people who have a mental health diagnosis or a diagnosable mental health challenge get help. And in the Black community, it's only about half the rate of white people. And there's a reason for that. I do think, however, that if we were to really look at health in general, we don't like to acknowledge when we have health challenges. You look at how long, you know, men will put off going to the doctor for anything, let alone when you add something to that is going to be perceived as weak.
Victor says a lot of the ways we diagnose and treat mental health in the United States are outdated and don't take into account the nuances of race, culture, ethnicity, or sexual orientation.
And so I think for that reason, too, it's difficult for people sometimes to really buy into the process. Because if I, for example, as a 50-something-year-old Black man, were experiencing severe depression, and recognizing that only about 4% of psychologists are Black and only about 2% of psychiatrists are Black, how willing am I going to be to go into the office of a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, 20-something-year-old female and sit on her couch and tell her, I don't feel like getting out of bed in the morning. I cry all the time and my sex drive is low. So I think there are a lot of challenges as to why we don't have more acceptance of acknowledging mental health challenges and getting help. But I think there are a lot of different reasons across the spectrum as to why people don't.
Another reason, Victor says, is the perception that depression symptoms are somehow feminine.
And, men are much less likely to divulge that they're experiencing depression, just in part because of the symptoms, you know, the tearfulness and you know, either sleeping too much or not sleeping enough and, you know, just some of the things that come along with it.
And that, he says, frequently leads to underdiagnosis and other issues.
Because men will then self-medicate, and then it becomes more an issue of alcoholism or drug issue, or men will sometimes lash out in violence because they They lack the self-control and lack sometimes the verbiage and the language to express what they're feeling other than in terms of anger.
Victor says lashing out and other behaviors during mental health emergencies lead to the criminalization of mental illness.
And when we continue to see, on any given day, there are 400,000 men and women in jails and prisons in this country who do have a diagnosable mental illness. And as long as we keep incarcerating folks who had infractions because of those challenges, and then we don't give them proper treatment when they're incarcerated, and then we don't have proper resources for them upon reentry after incarceration, that to me is discrimination.
We want to focus for a few minutes on Victor's word choice of mental health emergency, in part because he feels passionately about it, and in part because he makes a distinction that we think needs to be noted.
It just strikes me that when someone is experiencing a medical emergency, we call it that. We call it an emergency. When someone is experiencing a mental health emergency, we call it mental health crisis and crisis response. And, you know, I think the reason for that is that we don't have the resources to meet their needs at the time they need them. So it's not so much that the person is in crisis, it is the system that's in crisis.
By way of illustration, Victor shares about his recent medical emergency, which received a medical response.
I had a freak accident a few months back and ended up cutting my arm, and I had to go to an urgent care. And it was an emergency to me because I was bleeding and I couldn't stitch my own tricep. But when I walked in there, you know, they calmly had me, you know, sit. They got me set up, and within an hour, I was stitched up and out. It was routine to them because they had a process and they had resources to address it. We don't have that for people experiencing mental health emergencies, so we call it crisis.
And in a crisis, a common response is to dial 911.
We have a situation now where particularly Black males disproportionately have bad outcomes when interacting with law enforcement, and in the best of circumstances. And then if our response to someone having a mental health emergency is a law enforcement response, and you're responding in a situation with someone who would already disproportionately have a bad outcome, and then you add to that that this person's mental health emergency may cause them to be irrational, illogical, and seem even more dangerous. That's, again, the perfect recipe for poor outcomes. I think we've got a lot to do in that space of how we respond to folks that are having mental health challenges in general.
Victor says states like his have very robust crisis intervention and officer training programs.
You know, I think that was a very important step. The next step, I think, is to create a system where we have mental health professionals responding to mental health emergencies. Law enforcement is a support and a resource, but should not be our primary response to someone experiencing a mental health crisis.
Think about it. There's really no other health emergency for which our instinct is to call the police. Someone's had an accident or a heart attack. The focus is entirely on getting them the care they need, and we're probably going to call an ambulance. But if someone seems out of control and we're scared, well?
Our response system to someone having a mental health crisis is really not designed to protect and nurture the person having the crisis. It's designed to protect the rest of us from the person having the crisis. And that in itself is fundamentally wrong.
Victor believes our response to suicide is also fundamentally wrong.
You know, even when we think about, you know, the fact that so many people who died by suicide had a diagnosis of depression. But when a person dies by suicide, historically, we don't get into the depression. You know, if a man dies by suicide, you know, historically, the conversation is how selfish that was. You know, how selfish was it to take your life and leave your family members behind to have to deal with it, or that it was a coward's way out. And we don't understand how devastating depression can actually be when when someone describes, and I can only share what I have heard and read because I've not experienced it, but to imagine someone feeling like you're in such a deep, dark place that you would rather, you just want your pain to stop, but the only way that you can perceive that happening is to end your life. That's a very difficult thing for any of us to fathom, which probably also contributes to our, you know, inability or unwillingness to understand it, because we just cannot wrap our heads around being in that dark of a place.
I wonder sometimes if there's a fear of getting too close to it, because if it's as common as we know, and that probably means it's more common, and all of a sudden you hear that, it's, you know, I can watch a horror movie that has to do with situations I will never be in. I have a real hard time with horror movies that have to do with a situation I might be in. So I wonder if there's a little bit of just fear of getting a little too close to the stove.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I mean, it's funny to mention horror movies, because I was talking with someone recently, and we were talking about horror movies, and they could do any kind of slasher movie. They could do anything other than kind of paranormal, demonic kind of stuff. But the more we talked, it was because they just had this fear that, well, you know, what if it's true? What if it's real? You know, I could see that happening. So I think there's a lot of truth in what you're saying, is that when, you know, when people do see themselves as being potentially closer to that than they want to acknowledge, there's less reason to talk about it.
Which, Victor says, is another reason 24/7 crisis lines are so valuable.
That's one of the reasons, too, I think, that having the ability to have like the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, or, you know, other care lines that people can call in and talk to someone anonymously, or, you know, at least not having to do it face to face, and they can do it in the moment. I think those things are helpful, because then if you start to have concerns or fears or questions, there's something about picking up the phone and talking to someone who you don't think is going to judge you because they don't know you, and begin to talk through some of those things.
We strongly encourage everyone listening to program local or national crisis line numbers into your phone. It is so much harder in an emergency situation to calmly search for the resource, and you really never know when you might want or need to talk to someone. Also, please note that you do not need to be suicidal to call. You define what a crisis is for you at any given time. In the U.S., the national number is 800-273-8255, or 800-273-TALK, or you can text TALK to 741-741. But suicide prevention isn't only crisis lines and hospital visits.
Suicide itself is not the disease. It's not a disease. It is the worst possible outcome of the culmination of a lot of very complex issues, oftentimes including depression. But suicide prevention is about getting upstream. It's about reaching a person before they go into a suicidal crisis. And so all the things that we can do to normalize the conversation, to make resources available in communities where people live and where people can reach them, have access to them, making it affordable, all of those things are suicide prevention.
Victor says one of the lessons learned in working in state government during the pandemic is the need to partner differently.
But, you know, when I look at, you know, the Latinx community or the Black community, I know for me growing up, the church was always the gateway to the Black community. So I think part of what we have to do is figure out not just how do we integrate behavioral health into primary care and primary care into behavioral health, but how do we do a better job of integrating behavioral health into the church, into the YMCAs, into the community centers. I think we also have to think about how do we build a workforce that can speak to the unique needs of different populations.
One of the most cost and time-efficient ways to begin addressing those unique needs is to make better use of peer support specialists, those of us who can speak from experience about living with a condition or situation.
We can grow a workforce of peers much faster than we can grow a workforce of psychiatrists. I look here in North Carolina, we've got something like 4,000 certified peer specialists and about 1,500 that are gainfully employed. So one of the things that we've done in trying to even speak to the challenges with the pandemic, particularly for folks living with mental health challenges, is look at how do we utilize those peer resources. And I also think the more that you do that, the more people can see and talk to people who've lived it, who've been there, that does help to normalize it. And I think that's one of the things that we have to look at and do differently is is utilize those folks with lived experience.
That's the idea behind this podcast, actually. Not taking anything away from professionals, but there is power in hearing from people who have been there. People who can talk about the experience of living with a mental health condition from a place of knowing. Victor knows the value of connecting with our worth and leaves us with this.
The message I always like to leave with people, though, is no matter who you are, no matter what your challenges are, you matter, your life matters, your pain matters, and no matter how bad it gets, just try everything in your power to be here tomorrow.
Boy, that word fear came up a lot, didn't it? We fear what we don't understand in ourselves as well as in others.
True that. Yeah, I thought his, you know, acknowledgement that the vulnerability of all of us to having depression, to being depressed, is something that's not understood. And again, I think that the pandemic is bringing people closer to that understanding and reality, because all of mental health is a spectrum and we slide around on it. And, you know, there have to be a lot of people who before thought they were not on it, let alone in any risk of getting to the lower end of where you'd want to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mental health challenges are so complex that the police, you know, this is a whole movement we all know, right? This is like really up right now.
Yep.
And what are they trained in versus how do you have a mental health specialist in the car right there? Or I don't know if peer specialists are part of that or not, but I feel in Washington State, at least, that there's a real movement afoot to see the glaring gap between law enforcement and mental health support. And I love that it's being addressed.
Mm-hmm. And we're not criticizing law enforcement in any way. It's just that, are they mental health specialists? And the answer, you know, is no. And in the past, they may not have even been properly trained. It seems clear that many were not.
We truly hope
to be
that
able
our
to
podcast
handle,
brings a little
emergency.
More understanding.
So, yeah,
helps
it's a really
you better
good thing
articulate
that it's
your
happening.
Experience of
yeah,
depression
kind of
or better understand how to support someone else.
We invite you to join us for daily quotes on the Giving Voice to Depression Facebook page and on Twitter and Instagram at Voice Depression. It is a comfort to be among fellow travelers on depression's dark road. Who needs to read that?
If you're struggling,
speak
up.
No matter who you are,
if someone else
no matter
is,
what your challenges are, you matter. Your life matters. Your pain matters. And that no matter how bad it gets, try to be here tomorrow.
And I think it's also really empowering to think about turning, like over time, turning that pain around and inside out and be able to focus it on ourselves with compassion and understanding, and as well as supporting others, just becoming, you know, a better person through our pain.